Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Armchair Producers, episode 15. I'm George Terran, and as always, I'm joined by the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Travis Croft. How are you doing today?
I'm fine and dandy. We just watched the latest sneak trailer for the new Joker movie. I don't know if everybody out there has heard the buzz, but apparently to be played by Tommy Wiseau.
Tommy Wiseau.
And of course, the tagline is, "Why so serious?"
It was fucking awesome.
It was actually worth watching a really shitty fan-made trailer for the tagline alone.
Badly intercut between The Dark Knight and The Room. Most of it doesn't really sync up at all, except for just brief little moments like the bat pod coming towards the Joker and you just hear Tommy Wiseau saying, "Chick, chick, 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 chick." It's kind of perfect. And yeah, the tagline just sells it.
Would watch the shit out of that movie.
Yep.
It would be fucking awful, but it would be awful in the best possible way.
It's true.
It'd be if you could resurrect Ed Wood from the dead and put him in the director's chair.
Can you imagine Ed Wood and Tommy Wiseau? So,
in a movie directed by Uwe Boll.
that's just wrong. That's very bad. We're gonna pause quickly. Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Armchair Producers, episode 15. I am one of your hosts, George Terran, alongside the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Travis Croft. Do you feel like this is Groundhog Day?
I feel like I've been here before.
Yes. We had a wee bit of a snafu on the recording, and so we're doing this again. As we previously talked about, we just watched the fan-made trailer for Joker starring Tommy Wiseau. And it was fucking awesome. Worth it for the tagline.
Why so serious? and we were just musing over the concept of resurrecting Ed Wood to star in direct a film starring Tommy Wiseau. Written by Tommy, directed by Ed.
Produced by Uwe Boll.
Uwe Boll. and maybe starring Nicolas Cage.
Ooh. Damn, we just made the ultimate C-movie.
Holy trinity of horrible film. It would be a thing to behold, I imagine.
It would be like one of those car crashes that you just can't look away from, I think.
Like The Room, or anything Ed ever directed.
True.
Well, we're on a topic, though. Like, obviously, one of the big news items in the last week or so has been the talk of Jake Gyllenhaal stepping up to take over, or to step into the role of a Joker for a standalone.
Nah, you're getting your characters mixed up. Jake Gyllenhaal is apparently rumored to take over Batman is Joaquin Phoenix.
Joaquin, my bad, sorry.
He is going to be the Joker, and apparently he wants to. It's now just a matter of money. Joaquin, yeah.
I think he would be an interesting Joker, and I'm interested in the story, though I think I talked to you about this, is that obviously this is supposed to be a prequel. The genesis of the Joker character.
Yep.
Which I think we've talked about in the show before is like perhaps the Killing Joke.
That's the most generally agreed upon origin of the Joker, but everyone seems to really just prefer... He's got multiple. He can pick and choose as he likes. Much like in The Dark Knight, where he just keeps on saying different versions of how he got the scars, you know. I like him as the Joker. I think he would be a better fit for Joker, considering he was in the running for Doctor Strange back in the day. I think that he would have probably been very good as Doctor Strange, but I think that role is a bit more Cumberbatchian.
Once you sort of see someone in the role, it's hard to ever manage anybody else. Like, but Gyllenhaal at one point was in a line to actually, of course, replace Tobey Maguire.
Yeah, back in Spider-Man 2 days, because he had injured himself. He'd injured himself really badly.
He's back, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. And they weren't sure if he was going to be able to come back. So, yeah. I think it would be kind of interesting to have this Joker movie with Joaquin Phoenix and Jake Gyllenhaal, not only two very talented actors, but Jake Gyllenhaal taking on the mantle of the Batman and someone else taking on the mantle of the Joker. Weird kind of ships passing in the night of Brokeback Mountain.
Yes.
Brokeback Batman.
The interesting thing is that, of course, maybe I missed the memo here, but I don't think they'll necessarily be starring as those characters in the same film.
Well, we don't know. We just don't know, because this Joker movie is apparently standalone from the DCEU, being produced by Scorsese, being directed by Todd Haynes of the Hangover saga, I guess you call it.
Trilogy.
Yeah. none of it I really don't like either. Todd Haynes is generally known more as a comedy director, but people like Jay Roach, Adam McKay, they've certainly successfully played into more serious fare and stuff, certainly of recent date.
He's not completely unheard of.
War Dogs, was it?
He directed Far From Heaven back in 2002, which is a...
Holy shit, yeah!
Which is a wonderful movie.
Wait, is that really the same director?
Well, it's Todd Haynes, unless there are two Todd Haynes out there. Maybe it's a different Todd Haynes.
Fuck, if it is, whoa, that is huge difference in style.
It is.
Fucking hell.
Hang on a second, it's got to be a different one.
No, it can't, because...
No, it's Todd Phillips.
Todd Phillips. Is director. Okay.
We're getting our Todds mixed up. Todd Phillips, director of The Hangover.
Mm.
And
Todd Phillips, there we go.
Starsky and Hutch,
mm.
School for Scoundrels, old school road trip.
Yeah.
That kind of dreck. War Dogs, which wasn't very good.
Mm.
But yeah, this would be quite a step outside his normal oeuvre.
Mm.
Considering,
I mean, a lot of his things are kind of... Certainly his older stuff was more kind of teenage gross-out style, but there's always been a darker hinge to it. And that kind of suits the Joker. And I think that if he's willing... Joaquin Phoenix is a very intense actor, and if he is coming on board, they're probably going to have... He's probably going to have some say in the tone of the movie. And, of course, having Scorsese as a director, I mean, obviously he's done Light Affair, like that movie with Ben Kingsley and things... Fuck, I can't remember what it's called. It's about the silent movie director in France. It's got Sacha Baron Cohen in it.
The Artist?
With Asa Butterfield and... Chloe Moritz Glass. Chloe Moritz Grace, sorry. It's much, you know, calmer. But if he was to kind of inject some of the volatility of, well, some of the dementia of Shutter Island and say, hey, let's go for this kind of theme, bring in a comedic element. Hugo, yes, thank you. That would be quite cool.
I don't have a problem with it trying something different. I just think it's going to be a very strange concept they're trying to pull off when they've got two Jokers floating around, both when I watch. When I go to see the movies, it says DC at the start of it.
True.
Warner Brothers at the start of it.
Yeah.
And I go see Suicide Squad 2, I guess, in a year or so. I probably will. I mean,
yeah,
you know, we go see shit. We went and saw Ghostbusters and we didn't think we were going to like that.
That's true.
But you never know when you're going to be proven wrong.
Yeah, that is true.
So, you're going to go see Suicide Squad 2 in a year or year and a half, and I'll see Jared Leto probably playing the Joker again, and then, I don't know, 6 months, a year after that, I'll see the new next Joker movie, and it'll be Joaquin Phoenix.
As long as it's a very different style, I'm really okay with this. This is what I've wanted DC to do, rather than go down the shared cinematic universe of Marvel, which in its own right is great. I'm watching my way back through all the Marvel movies more or less in chronological order, and it's great. I still think that the DC characters, they're compelling enough and unique enough that you can tell really interesting genre pieces with these characters and have very different styles. Like the idea of kind of going, all right, we've got the Batman, Chris Nolan universe, which is highly regarded. Everyone loves it. And then there's also the people who really love the Tim Burton universe. And there are even some fans of some of the early Joel Schumacher ones, like the first one, Batman Forever. It would be really cool to have just these sort of like one shots of, yeah, this is my take on a Batman story. This is my version.
We've talked about it before. Yeah. I think it's a good thing. I'd just be interested to see how audiences react to having to know two different versions of a Joker coming out reasonably close to each other. I mean, it's worked okay in television so far, in the sense we've got the Flash on TV is different to the Flash on in the movies now, and I don't think that upset too many people, probably because nobody watches The Flash.
Well, I think more people watch The Flash than watch Justice League, probably, which is kind of sad.
But yeah, so it'll be interesting. I think Gyllenhaal as Batman could work. I don't have a problem with Affleck as Batman.
We
spent a lot of time talking about Affleck,
how
happy we were with his performance in Dawn of Justice, and
he just doesn't seem to want to do it.
He doesn't seem to want to do it, and he wasn't. He was completely. I think he was overlooked a little bit in Justice League. I don't think they did very much with the character, and
yeah,
he was just seemed kind of superfluous.
Yeah, he just paid for everything.
I'm very rich, you know. What I was like, superpower.
I'm rich.
It's just a shame. I mean, there have been moments. I would actually go on the record and say I think the best Batman moment, action moment anyway, on screen has been the fight scene in Dawn of Justice, where basically the Batman Arkham Asylum fight scene.
Yeah, warehouse.
In the warehouse. I mean, I don't know that anyone's ever pulled off a Batman fight scene like that before, or will they ever again? I mean,
I think they will, but you need to get the right director in, and that's, say what you want about Zack Snyder, he can, when he wants to, he can really direct cinematic action. Like the stuff that he did in 300 was really good. The action sequences in Sucker Punch are really good. When he gets too excited and goes, oh yeah, I'm going to splurge my load on this one scene and have just CGI everywhere, you get kind of the shambles of action that Man of Steel was, and most of Batman v Superman. But that sequence where it's like, no, we're going to use physical effects, we're going to have just very well choreographed pieces. He knows how to film that in a really kinetic way, and that works really, really well. It's just a shame that in pretty much every other Batman, when Batman has to go fighting, the suit just fails because he just doesn't have enough maneuverability in it. And it's like Christian Bale kind of said, yeah, next time we do Batman, make sure that you can move your neck.
Yeah.
It's like, that might be an important thing if you're going to be a crime fighter.
That's a shame that Affleck wants to walk away from it. I think I would have been very interested to see a Batman film he started and directed.
Yeah, yeah. He still said that he would be keen to direct one, but I don't know. He keeps changing his story every bloody
week. Who knows? He's a bit like, he's becoming the Tarantino of the vaporware films that he wanted to do.
That's very true.
Should we move on and talk? What have you been watching this week? You were talking today about a very busy day at work where you managed to chew through a film on Netflix.
I chewed through one of the fairly new films to arrive on Netflix. It's called The Ritual. This is by nearly first-time movie film director David Bruckner. He did there's an anthology horror movie series called Southbound, and he did one of those. I haven't watched it myself, never even heard of it. Fairly well regarded, apparently. But this movie, it's got one real notable actor in it, and that's Rafi Spall. He's most notable for Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz. He's the son of Timothy Spall. People kind of know his face. It's like, oh, that guy. Yeah, okay. There's basically the story of this is from a novel by Adam Neville. A group of four friends, Phil, Dom, Hutch, and Luke, embark on a hiking trip in Sarek National Park in northern Sweden to honor their friend Rob, who was killed 6 months earlier in a convenience store robbery. After Dom falls and injures his knee, Hutch consults the group map and decides on an alternative route through the woods that would take them half the time. The group begin to encounter unexplained phenomena, including a gutted bear and strange symbols carved under the trees. As night falls, they come up upon a rundown cabin and stay in it for the night. The cabin is mostly empty, save for a strange wooden effigy in the attic shaped like a human torso, with antlers for hands. During the night, each is plagued by nightmares. Luke wakes up with a strange set of puncture wounds on his chest, while Phil is compelled to pray to the effigy inside the cabin. They continue their travels deeper into the woods, trying to find a way out. Now, this movie is stock standard, low-budget English horror thriller fare. Similar to like The Descent, Dog Soldiers, even Dead Man's Shoes. And there's a few hints of Benicio del Toro in it, which makes sense because the creature construction is by someone called Keith Thompson, and I made a note of it because it's actually really good. He's got a good eye. He has worked with Benicio del Toro, Guillermo del Toro, sorry.
The other one.
On Pacific Rim, Crimson Peak, and the TV series The Strain. So the quality of the monster creation here, there's a legacy to it, and it does actually look good compared to most low-budget British fare where they cobble together something that doesn't actually look good upon closer inspection.
Interestingly, just looking at here, the script is written by Joe Barton, who no one would have heard of. But he is known for writing several episodes of the British TV series Humans, which stars Catherine Parkinson, which is what I don't know if you've actually ever watched any of this. It's fucking brilliant.
I've watched like one episode.
I don't know if you'd like it. I mean, our taste in science fiction, we've established rather different. but I think it's a really well done British television show, so it doesn't surprise me that this might be a step above what one normally sees in a... But that's it. I feel like low-budget British horror is usually a step above what you get out of the States. Yes, the States, I make a Saw film or a Saw knockoff like Insidious or something for $20 million, release it on a long weekend, everyone takes their fucking date to 100%. See it. It's got half a dozen jump scares, and I make $100 million in a weekend and I'm happy.
100%. This thing is done on a real micro budget. You can tell that. But what the budget that they have, they use very well overall. I definitely prefer British horror thrillers compared to most of the American fare, especially the Blumhouse stuff generally. It's very stock standard and not actually very scary, their stuff.
Well, if you look at some of the ones we've watched recently, like The Girl with All the Gifts, British, again, they do a lot with a little.
Yeah.
If you go back to a film 10 years ago, like The Descent, does a lot of a little, and in fact, one of the scariest, I would argue, I think the scariest film I've ever seen, on a micro budget, or I can't remember the name of a film, but we watched it at Patrice's house that time, the people for masks and...
Oh, yeah, it was...
I can't remember what it was called, but, you know... Yeah.
I know the guy you mean. He's starting to get a bit more interest. He did a movie like 2 years ago with... Tom Hiddleston, The Flats or Flat 47 or something like that. This movie is very much in that vein. Very much so. It's kind of low light shot. It's there's no filters or no real CGI except for on this creature, and they use that well. They follow the golden rule of creature feature films. They do not really show this creature. It's only extreme long shots or through trees or real extreme close-ups or very, very heavy shadow, just keeping the threat better.
Kill list.
Who's the director?
Ben Wheatley.
Yes, thank you. Keep a note on that name, people, because he will make it big eventually. This movie, the four guys, Luke, Hutch, Phil and Dom, are all very quintessential English men in their mid-30s, late 40s. And I know each and every one of these guys, theoretically speaking. They are my circle of friends who are at that point in their lives where they're very clearly grown men. They still want to have a lad's weekend away. I already mentioned the similarities to The Descent. It opens in a very similar way, where The Descent opens up with the girls all finishing up one of their kind of cave diving expeditions, and then tragedy strikes, cuts to months later and going on. Exactly the same story here. They're out on the town. They go to get some beers. Luke is with them. That's Raffi Spall's character. And then the place is being held up by these junky thugs. And Raffi Spall's character hides, and Rob, their other friend, gets killed in the process. And then it cuts to 6 months later, and they're doing what they had previously kind of said, yeah, let's do this as a lad's night, a lad's getaway thing. So it's a bit cliched and divisive, but it's fine as a tool to get them into their position. And they sell they sell the relationship between them pretty well. What else have I got? The tension builds nicely. So director David Bruckner, as I've said, he doesn't have much of a budget for this. There was no information on Wikipedia really about how much, but he uses the location very well, uses the light very well, and he's got some solid actors delivering solid performances. Great use of ambient noise and sound to add the fear, tension, and dread constantly as well. Halfway in, and the biggest problem is the tension isn't cranked up enough or isn't consistent to warrant the pace of the edit. It drags a little bit, but not offensively so. So it's very slow twisting, whereas someone like Denis Villeneuve, who's very good at that taut tension, slow burn stuff, David, the director, just isn't
You are comparing him to potentially, I think, one of the possibly the greatest working director in the moment.
Exactly. It's, you know, he's emulating that, and that you can see that he's emulating it. He's just not quite there to pull it off properly. So it does feel a bit draggy. Luke's nightmares are well done, and they kind of integrate into the real world with great sound design, and his movements and how they cut from his nightmares to the real world, and how that kind of the barriers between those two blend works really well, and it just continuously improves throughout the film right up to the end. Music's very generic, but it serves the purpose. Everything about the film is good, near to very good, but it just misses the mark because there isn't really any personality in the film. Solid performances, but nothing that make it stand out. So The Descent and Dog Soldiers, Dead Man's Shoes, those, you just kind of really feel the director and writer's oeuvre. Their signature is all over it. Even kind of Alex Garland stuff like 28 Days Later, it's got that je ne sais quoi, makes it a bit different from the rest of the pack. This doesn't really, which is a shame.
Sounds like a director maybe still trying to find his voice.
100%. He's not done much. He did a short film with this anthology, but this is his first feature film. It's great that it got picked up by Netflix because he's going to get a lot of eyeballs on him. He's going to be able to do something much meatier next time.
You know, I often think to myself, a lot of Australian directors really come out with bang.
Yeah.
So if you look at someone like David Micod, or Micod, how do you pronounce it? He did that movie with Ben Mendelsohn, I can't remember the name of it. Animal Kingdom.
Yes.
Because Jackie Weaver.
Yeah, that's quite an explosion onto the scene. Quite a statement.
But he's done almost nothing since.
Yeah.
We're not saying nothing. He's worked in films. None of them have been anywhere near as good as that.
Mm.
And none of them have been noticed. And I'd suggest I'm sure he'll have a career on. He's made more movies than I ever have.
Yeah.
But you kind of wonder about someone like that who bursts on, or John Hillcoat, who bursts on the scene. I think he was a director of... What is his first film? The Proposition, I think. The director of Chopper as well.
Yeah.
Really burst on the scene and actually got a lot of notice in Hollywood and got jobs overseas. But again, none of them have really actually gone on with it and produced a really great sort of body of work other than their first film. So just having a competent, if perhaps a little mediocre film to start with, isn't always necessarily a bad thing.
Building up the resume and the fact that there's nothing wrong with this film in any way, shape, or form. It is good. It is almost very good. It's a really good calling card to say, look, I built up this much tension with this budget, with these actors who all do really, really sterling jobs. Like some of the other guys, there's Robert James Collier, who plays Hutch. He's not really done anything. He's more of a model, and he's quite a standout, especially considering the fact that probably the least experienced out of all of the actors. Is Arash Ali as Phil, who he was one of the guys in Four Lions. He was the younger guy who basically gets pulled into the group because he has a car. And then Sam Troughton as Dom. I recognize his face. He's a bit part in Alien vs. Predator. So it's kind of these guys who haven't really done much. Rafi Spall is the biggest name because he's worked on Edgar Wright movies, basically. So the fact that they've made this very solid movie that is a good thriller more than a horror movie, I think he's got a lot of potential. It's probably designed as a found footage movie. When you're watching it, there's certain scenes where it just feels like the camera's in the wrong place. It feels like this was probably written as a found footage movie. To illustrate the illusion of being in the woods, the illusion of being in the woods that can deliver, you know, that kind of, is that something I see? What's that? And you, as the movie goes on, you keep on looking closer and closer at the tree line and into the shadows, trying to see something before it's actually there. It's a nice touch, but it doesn't quite fit with the rest of the direction, which is a little bit more blunted than that. Some of the elements feel a little bit like M. Night Shyamalan in his early career, Sixth Sense and Signs and that sort of stuff. Ralph Spall is really solid throughout the movie, and it really makes me want to see him in more stuff because he really sells it well. He's, when he first kind of broke onto the scene, he was stockier and really, he's always got that London accent, you know, he's kind of talking like a lad, you know. He's still got that here, but it's a little bit more subdued. He's aging up well, and I think that if enough people see this, people are going to start going, "Hey, you know what? You could be a supporting character in a DC or Marvel movie. You know, we like our British actors in these things.
Usually a villain.
Yeah, So I think he's got the potential for that. But I really liked it. I wasn't expecting to like it. I watched the trailer, and it's very, all right. Kind of feels like The Descent. Yeah, it is kind of like The Descent, but I really like The Descent, so
I always say, like, people would go many years ago, or like a band like Jet or Wolfmother, they just sound like Led Zeppelin. I'm like, well, if you're going to rip someone off,
yeah,
better to rip off Led Zeppelin than the Bay City Rollers.
Don't you mock the Bay City Rollers.
I'll have you there, I'll step you outside, so, and fisticuffs.
How about you? Yeah, so that's my review of The Ritual. I do recommend it. Especially as it's just freely available on Netflix.
And
yeah,
if you're looking for something a bit spooky with the misses on a Friday night, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, what better way to spend Valentine's than getting a little bit creepy?
Well, yes, that's a possibility. Certainly beats going to an overpriced restaurant.
True. What have you been watching? I've been talking too long.
We have been. I think we'll be honest. We haven't actually had a very long break between recordings.
The illusion of distribution.
Pay no attention of a man behind the curtain. I did manage to smash out a movie I've been looking forward to seeing for a little while now.
Mm.
And that is Darkest Hour. Not The Darkest Hour, starring Emil Hirsch in Moscow.
Aww.
Unfortunately. This is Darkest Hour instead. No, the. Leave out the because that film's got a
missing word.
That has an 18 on Metacritic. This has a 75. There's almost 60 point difference. Mm. So, those who are unaware, this film tells the story. So it's set during the early days of World War II. The fate of Western Europe hangs in the balance. And Winston Churchill has just assumed the prime ministership of Great Britain.
This is Gary Oldman?
This is the Gary Oldman film.
The Oscar nominated.
Oscar nominated. He is unbackable for the Best Actor Oscar.
Okay.
Unbackable, like $1.20.
Yeah.
He is almost certainly going to win that Oscar. Okay. Look, now, I've seen some of the other contenders, a couple. Mm. I think Best Supporting Actor is going to be a close one. I think our mate Sam Rockwell is going to win it this year.
I hope so.
Again, unbackable favourite. But on the Best Actor front, it's all about Gary Oldman.
Okay.
And it's Oscar bait. Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I actually believe, ironically, the film doesn't feel Oscar baity. I think if we talked last year about, Hidden Figures.
Yeah, yeah.
And that felt Oscar baity to me, despite the fact it was a good film.
Mm.
It just, yeah, it was women, they were African-American, they were doing science jobs. You know, it's
a lot of buzz things.
You know, it's just ticking boxes left, right, center, despite the fact that it was fine.
Yeah.
This, I believe, was a passion project for a number of people involved.
Mm.
Gary Oldman studied, apparently, Winston Churchill for a very, very long time, like a year, I think I read, watching video or footage of him and learning his mannerisms and his cadence of speech. And so that's not something you do just because you want your Oscar.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's exactly the kind of film that the
it
gets you the Oscar. It's the kind of film the Academy likes. I mean, Americans like Churchill.
True.
It's about the war. If we go back to Colin Firth playing the King in the King's Speech a couple of years ago, that role in this film is played by Ben Mendelsohn, actually, same King.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, who is the only non-Brit in the film.
Okay.
And he is I think Ben Mendelsohn's one of the most interesting actors going around at the moment, because those of us who grew up in Australia, we've been watching him in film for 20, 25 years now. Mm-hmm. He's been a very well-known Australian actor, but just in the last probably 7 or 8 years, maybe, he's sort of got himself a foothold in the United States. And
yeah.
I think, again, that was coming out of Animal Kingdom in 2010. Of course, he was in Rogue One. He was in The Dark Knight. He's just popping up all over the shop now.
Yeah.
And he's fantastic. He really fucking looks like the king. And he pulls up, he has the lisp that the king had and stuff like that in this film. So it's interesting to watch this film, having seen the King's Speech, and you sort of go, it's almost like the King's Speech ends and this film could pick up, and you could, obviously it takes off on a different character being about Churchill.
Of course, yeah.
But he has a very important role in the film.
Yeah.
Other stars, so Gary plays Winston Churchill, Lily James plays Elizabeth Layton, his secretary.
Okay.
For those who don't know Elizabeth James, she played the love interest in Baby Driver.
Oh, yes.
She was also in Sense and Sensibility and Zombies or whatever. No, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, so my one.
Yeah.
I actually saw that film at the cinema because a friend of mine likes Jane Austen and I hated it. But she was wonderful in it. She's very, very beautiful and
she's very pretty,
A very, very fine actress as well. Kristen Scott Thomas plays Clementine.
She's always solid.
As I said, Ben Mendelsohn. Yeah. And I imagine many people, I didn't recognize a great deal of others.
Who is it directed?
It is directed by Joe Wright.
Ah, Mr. Atonement.
Mr. Atonement. So, is he British? He does a lot of British films.
Yeah, he's British.
I think he must be.
British,
Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
An actual Pride and Prejudice. No zombies.
He knows how to direct an Oscar bait movie.
He does. Written by Anthony McCartan, who I believe this was a passion project for as well.
Okay.
Anthony also wrote The Theory of Everything from a couple of years ago.
Okay.
Another film.
Oscar. Yep.
And it is full of guys you go, oh, him.
Yeah.
And I imagine you do the same having grown up in Britain. There'll be very many famous faces. You go, he was on EastEnders or something.
What? Please.
I don't know.
EastEnders. See, there's a difference between England and Australia. Everyone in Australia watches Home and Away and Neighbours. In England, most people watch EastEnders or Coronation Street. I did not.
Why am I not surprised? You're always the contrarian.
I know.
Mr. Terran. So this is I've heard some criticisms of this film, and I think the film has been nominated for a number of awards beyond, and I don't think it'll win them.
I don't think it's been nominated for Best Director.
Potentially not. I haven't seen... Joe Wright is not nominated for Best Director. Interestingly, Gary Oldman's been only nominated for the Academy Award a couple of times.
Which is strange considering...
The quality of...
But then at the same time, a lot of the stuff that he's done has not been... I mean, the Academy is changing its tastes quite a bit, but up until very recently, genre fare has not really been the choice of champions.
He only has been nominated for Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy before now.
That was really good.
I'm a bit of a World War II buff, and obviously I've seen a lot of footage of Churchill, and I tell you what, Gary Oldman inhabits that role. Something like you almost forget at times you're watching an actor. The makeup is incredible. I would not be surprised if this won several technical awards for makeup, costuming, sets, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Especially for makeup, because, it's flawless. Okay. It's like when you watch Monster and you know that Charlize Theron under there.
Or you watch
The Hours and you know underneath that nose is Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
And you never forget that that's Charlize Theron or that's Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
I genuinely, at several times in the film, almost forgot that that was Gary Oldman underneath all that makeup. So... Okay. Gary deserves his Oscar. The film, it's fairly stock standard stuff. I mean, we already know the story. It's a nice biopic.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked before in the past about biopics that try and bite off more than they can chew. Mm. You don't want to try and tell the life story of someone like Winston Churchill in 2 hours.
Is quite insane. And a lot of his earlier stuff and his later stuff, his private life, it's not what you want your war hero to be remembered for.
It would be a fascinating television series because this is a guy who was a journalist. He served in the Boer War. He was a POW. He was First Lord of the Admiralty in World War One. The architect of the disastrous Gallipoli landings.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the wilderness between the wars. He was the only voice against saying, do not trust Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was elected, nominated Prime Minister, he won the war. Then he lost the general election. Mm-hmm. In 1945, after winning the war, the POMs voted him out.
There are not many people who would do that.
And then he became Prime Minister again.
Yep.
He had an incredible life.
It's a rollercoaster.
It would be an amazing TV show, and I'm sure there probably has been one over the years that I'm not familiar with, but... In 2 hours, you can't tell that story.
No.
2.5, 3 hours, maybe.
So what's the timeline for this?
We're set in a month.
Okay.
This is set in a month. The first month, essentially, of his prime ministership. We start the film with them going, we can't support Chamberlain. France is about to fall.
Mm-hmm.
And the film basically starts with them deciding that the only way they're going to be able to, the Conservative Party in Britain, are going to be able to remain in government, or is to select a leader that the opposition, the Labour Party, will accept. Now, I believe historically that's actually not true, that they would only accept Churchill, but that's the way the film sells it, is the Labour Party wouldn't support nobody else except Churchill.
Mm. See, now, as a political, British politics master, I have no idea. No,
well,
there's no way of finding out.
I had to read about it.
Yeah.
I'm not that familiar with British wartime politics. The way the story is framed is the fact that he is not pop, and he was not popular with his Conservative Party. He was very much an outsider.
Ooh, yeah.
And he's put forward as a compromise candidate by his party who do not approve of him.
Nope.
On the proviso that they expect he will fail.
Yep.
And the way the film is set is that they are setting him up to fail so that they can have their, they can completely discredit him in the eyes of the rest of the parliament and then replace him with their chosen nominee, Sir Anthony Eden, who was an architect of appeasement. And obviously, now his name is probably not quite as badly remembered as Neville Chamberlain, but he's not well remembered for that.
I don't remember either of those names.
Well, I mean, if anybody who knows anything about politics, Neville Chamberlain was the person who basically sold out Czechoslovakia to Hitler.
Oh.
And basically nice came back and said, well, peace in our time, and basically gave Hitler everything he wanted, and Hitler just kept going, I'll have that too. And that, and then, fuck it, I'll take Poland too. So he
voluntarily knocked down the first domino.
Pretty much. He obviously the policy of appeasement completely discredited after the end of that. But that's the way the film's framed, is that they want Churchill to fail.
Okay.
And the film sort of, in his first month, we see him coming used to the role. We have the machinations in the background. In fact, he doesn't get along with the king at all.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. There's a nice little subplot about the relationship between him and the king.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically builds up to the Dunkirk evacuation, which actually I found myself quite interesting. This will make a wonderful companion piece to Dunkirk.
Yeah.
You can watch
go
them
from
in,
this to
the, or either order, because the film ends with this Dunkirk evacuation.
Okay, yeah.
So you can watch them in either order, and it's almost like they're going on concurrently.
Okay.
In a way. So they'd be fine companion pieces in that sense.
Mm.
I guess the weakest part of a film for me is a scene towards the end, and I guess I'll give spoiler alert here to anybody who doesn't want to know any more about
this. Based on a historical event.
Event happens in this film that didn't actually happen.
Oh, okay. The Cloverfield monster turned
up. Yeah, no. I mean, I thought that was overkill, personally. the fact that, you know, little Nicky was involved, it's like...
Hey, he always has a place in every movie.
Exactly. Well, you know, the walk-on role for Adam Sandler was a strange choice.
And he really needed it as well.
But there's a scene... Churchill was well known for disappearing from the Admiralty or Downing Street and just appearing somewhere in the city and talking to regular people. That happened.
Yeah.
But this film doesn't have that. What it happens is he gets out of his car one day while he's driving to Westminster and takes the subway and ends up talking to a bunch of British people about whether he should be suing for peace. Because things weren't going well for Britain at the time.
Ooh.
That never happened. At least as far as we know, that never happened. Mm. And from what I can understand, most historians agree that he never wavered in his determination that they should not sign a peace treaty with the Axis powers, Germany and Italy. Mm. So knowing that almost, and I'd heard some people talk about it, knowing that almost certainly never happened, really, I mean, I guess if he didn't realise and you bought that.
Yeah.
I guess it'd be different, but I'm sitting there going, it's a nice scene. It's a very nicely put together scene.
Mm.
There's even a black man on the train, and Churchill doesn't blink. And Churchill was a well-known racist.
Yeah.
It's hard. That kind of devalued the film a little bit for me, knowing that was completely staged. And I know why it was put in there from a narrative perspective.
Of course, yeah.
But I guess if you're telling a true story and then you, and everything looks so authentic and you have such an authentic performance, to then go and undercut that with something
rewrite history
that almost certainly didn't happen. Yeah. If you had him in a bombed out house, because that kind of shit did happen. And maybe I would have bought the fact that, you know, he was maybe considering a peace treaty. I'm like, I don't know, maybe I'm getting a little bit too nitpicky here. It didn't really mean I didn't enjoy the film. I very much enjoyed the film, and I very much recommend everybody see it. And Gary, I said, will win his Oscar. Maybe the film wins a few awards. It won't be Best Picture, I don't think. It just took it down a notch for me. That it kind of took me out of a story in a way that said, it's a fantasy, you know, and like it's almost like, I don't know if I found myself, there are parts of this film where I'm like, and not you probably, but if you were a very patriotic British person, which I think we're fair to say you're not, because you don't watch EastEnders.
No, I don't. Or Doctor Who.
So if one were a very patriotic British person, I imagine there would be a point towards the end of this film when you would swell with your British pride. And you know, there's a great scene where he addresses Parliament, and, you know, there's the famous, we will fight them on the beaches, we will fight them on the landing grounds, and like, and that kind of thing. And you would fall with pride. And it's almost the British version of, like, I don't know, that scene at the end of Saving Private Ryan where the guy collapses on the grave of Tom Hanks's grave, you know, Matt Damon.
Yeah.
And, like, you have, pull away to a fluttering American flag, and you're like,
basically any Scot who watches Braveheart and Freedom.
That kind of it's in professional wrestling you might call it a cheap pop. You know, like, you might come out and go, it's great to be here in Detroit, and he knows the name of a town,
he paid attention to where he was,
nobody rocks like Springfield. It's cheap pop. It's obviously it's a British film.
Yeah,
it's got a wider audience than just Brits. But I kind of felt like a little bit like, you're kind of peddling here.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I give it. I'm sounding negative here. I mean, I'm getting nitpicky about a very fine piece of work.
Yeah, well, there you go. Two very positively reviewed moves.
And I think you'll find Darkest Hour still playing in cinemas.
Yeah.
Today, so get out, and I'm sure it'll be on DVD soon.
It won't be too far, because I mean, the Oscars are a month away, I think.
A couple of weeks,
yeah. So it'll appear fairly soon after that, I think. Especially if it wins any Oscars, they'll want to get their second wind.
Well, that's what they do. It's like, winner of 4 Oscars. Yeah. Technical ones, but
Well, come on. Suicide Squad is an Oscar winner.
Makeup.
Yeah.
Best hot pants.
Yeah. Should we talk about Star Trek Discovery, or should we hold off for now?
I haven't watched the finale, so
we'll hold off, and we'll do the part one and part two of the finale. We'll take a quick break. Last little portion of the show. Travis, you've got some Wolfenstein 2 DLC comments.
Yes. For those of you who are regular listeners will recall Wolfenstein, the New Colossus I played last year and very much enjoyed. I very much enjoyed the last one as well. New Blood, was that what it was called?
Yes.
So foolishly, I, after playing the game, decided to buy the game pass, the season pass. The
DLC.
The season pass. I thought it was, it's Bethesda, and it's not EA.
True.
You know, we're not completing it.
Yeah.
No, it's not loot boxes or anything. But when you get the game, you get unlocked to something called the Freedom Chronicles, which is one of the extra bonus options in the game. Okay. And you get to play episode 0 of that, which is a taster of the 3 different DLCs that were going to come out. Gunslinger Joe was the first DLC, come out in mid-December.
Yep.
And it was underwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And just January 30th, we had The Diaries of Agent Silent Death come out.
Mm-hmm.
And unsurprisingly, this was also underwhelming. Why is it underwhelming? Just to cover off, in case anybody out there is looking at the game and decides to buy it and goes, oh, DLC, maybe. It's short.
Mm-hmm.
I think I knocked it off in a couple of hours.
Okay.
The main game was 20 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And when you compare it to other DLC content, I think at the time Gunslinger Joe came out, I talked a lot about the DLC that came out for Borderlands if you bought the DLC event. There was dozens of hours of content there. So Bethesda really, really...
shit in the bed a little.
A little bit. I mean, it's not terrible. It's just they're being very stingy. They're not giving you much for your money. But it's not as $25 for three extra 6 hours or so if the third one's anything like these two. It doesn't use anything particularly... It reuses a lot of locations from the actual main game, or at least slightly different skinned locations from the main game.
Yeah.
So you're not really exploring anywhere particularly new that wasn't already in the game the first time around. And it reuses a very a game mechanic, used a reasonable amount in the main game as well. So that was a complaint I had about Gunslinger Joe. In that game, your character had the special ability to crash through walls because he was a quarterback or football player. And that was something that you could do in the main game as well. You could find a certain upgrade and you could, your BJ Blazkowicz could bash through walls and doors. And this one, is you're a spy, it focuses very heavily on stealth. You can shrink yourself really small and go for really tiny, small holes in walls and on the doors and stuff like that. And again, that was a mechanic with an upgrade you can find in the main game. BJ Blazkowicz could do the same thing. So it's a mechanic we've already used.
Just...
hyper focused on that. So obviously there are a lot more little gaps and stuff you can crawl into in the maps in this game, because obviously that's encouraging you to do that. So there's more spaces for you to use the mechanic than maybe in the main game, which yeah, it was kind of a, by the time you got it, you were so fucking overpowered anyway, you really didn't need to
matter.
But yeah, so, and plus the stealth mechanic in this game was one of the weakest. It's a game where it's very hard to be stealthy, because It's just there's no real way to tell whether they're going to see you or not. It seems to be pot luck sometimes. So,
and some, a game like Wolfenstein, you don't look at it thinking, yeah, I want this to be, I want to play this as if I'm playing Thief. It's, you want to be fucking powered and you just want to go through and kill Nazis.
I guess you want to play it whichever way you want to play, which is fine. And I like that about the last game. Stealth was a very heavy focus in the last game as well. And it's not all about stealth, because there are parts where you've just got to go full auto. But there are some elements that just where you can do it full auto. And usually first I try 20 minutes to do it stealthy and go, fuck it, and get my dual machine guns out and go, oh, well, should you still do it from the start?
Do this anyway.
but yeah, it's not a game. I mean, there is a stealth element. So I guess that's kind of a nice thing about these DLCs in a sense, is that they're almost three different elements of the game, three different ways you can play it. So
yeah,
and it's just very much encouraging you to use the stealth option in this one. But it's short, it's unoriginal, it doesn't introduce anything new. The actual character herself is quite nice, and that she sort of plays the hard-boiled secret agent whose husband was killed during the war and has been living on a beach getting drunk every day in Brazil, who comes and gets called back into action to assassinate the people who killed her husband and stuff. And you're like, that's cool, it's a nice little, you know, gender reversal on unusual trope. And the way they, again, with same with Gunslinger Joe, the way they frame it with sort of comic book style, you know, cut scenes in between the missions is nice. But Jesus, guys. I mean, I guess I wasn't expecting anything more considering what I got last time.
Do you feel like they're kind of more like tasters of, hey, you probably went through run and gun style before. Try this out. You might like it. Maybe try going through the game again in stealth mode.
Are there parts of where in the game where you kind of got to do the stealth mode thing? I would be very surprised if... I mean, I guess there could be people out there who just don't care for it at all. And I don't, I'm not a stealth kind of guy. I don't like stealth games much. But
I do.
I usually just get bored and just want to shoot people.
Yeah.
But I'd be very surprised if people... you hadn't got to a point in the game where you kind of had to do that anyway. Because the game itself, the main game, very much encourages it. It could be seen that way. I just say, like... It's just lazy. It's just lazy. Like, we can't be fucked coming up with any new content, so we'll just put it, you know, create some new characters, which is nice. But really short, we'll just reuse a bunch of reskin maps and game elements from the main game and use that. And I'm like, well, that's not very interesting.
There seems to be a trend with DLC at the moment. Like, your thoughts mimic a lot of what I've heard online as well. They recently announced the DLC for Far Cry 5, which is coming out soon. And there's three elements. One is set in the Vietnam War, one is a zombie runner, and one is set out in space. Now, one of those things is not like the other. And this is Far Cry. So it's a very weird hodgepodge. And I'm wondering, Because this year we're going to be getting, well, PlayStation are going to be getting an exclusive Spider-Man game. And the Square Enix are doing a Avengers game. I'm wondering if these are kind of easy ways for these companies to cash in a little bit extra on the DLC and also kind of give a little bit of a this is proof of concept kind of thing for some of their things. Like in Wolfenstein 2, you've got the shrinking down Ant-Man game. You've got smashing through walls. Hulk. You know,
bring out that Juggernaut game we've always wanted.
Yeah, I'm the Juggernaut, bitch!
I have to say, though, if you're in Gunslinger Joe, because it does encourage you quite often to use that power to smash through walls. I wonder if I'm the only... I don't know, I may have mentioned this last time, but I'll say it again. The only time... I wonder if I'm the only person who, every time I do it, I smash through a wall and kill some Nazi and go, oh, yeah! And I can't not do it. Oh, yeah!
See, now, that's another time that I could do, you know.
Yeah, but Kool-Aid guy, the game.
Well, you know, they had fucking Sprite video games and stuff that came free on cover of magazines. God, yeah. We could bring that back.
Marketing.
Premium games.
But yeah, right. You're right. It does. I could see that. If maybe when they get to Wolfenstein 3.
Yeah.
They decide, or they want to have a spin-off game that's not based around the main arc of B.J. Blazkowicz's story of Bethesda is set up.
Yeah.
If they wanted to, if one of these characters proved particularly popular or cook off with the audience, they could, you know, make a game based around one or maybe all three of them, you know. Yeah. Like, it's an interesting way to do it, is to introduce a new character and that kind of thing. But if it puts some more effort into, I mean, it's one of the great things about the main game is it's got story. There's a story of it. I think we talked about it last, but the first Bethesda Wolfenstein game came out. It's like, how do you put story in a fucking Wolfenstein game?
Yeah.
Like, these games were running, they invented run and gun back in the 90s. But they found a really interesting and inventive way to tell a story throughout the game. And you can ignore it if you're not interested. And you become actually fairly emotionally invested in this, in the progress of a character and his outcome. Less so in a sequel because it gets a bit silly. But, that's one of the things I really was impressed by about these games by Bethesda and the fact that they kind of completely abandoned that. It seems in the DLC. I mean, I guess I shouldn't be surprised. I mean, this is why DLC has a bad reputation.
Yeah. Yeah, there's very, very few pieces of DLC that kind of really feel like they're worth it. I saw today that Activision posted earnings for DLC alone. This year, $4 billion on DLC. That's fucking insane.
We need to stop paying for it. I mean, I don't know. I'm as bad as you. I talked about it last week. I bought the season pass for The Division and never used it. I've bought the season pass for this. I guess if you really love the game and you want more, that's the emotional buying decision they're hoping to capitalize on. But I got to resolve not to do it until I actually get to see what it is first.
Well, Batman, the last Batman game was notoriously bad for it because they said, oh, yeah, there's going to be DLC planned. It's going to cost $49.99, almost the same as a fucking game. And they didn't give any details about what it was going to be. Like, really? You're just going to say, come on, give us money. And people did.
Well, I mean,
really?
I guess that was on the strength of the fact of the games that it made up to that point.
Yeah, but the previous game's DLC wasn't that good either.
I mean, the same thing with Fallout did the same thing. I think they wanted a lot of money for it. I didn't do that, though, and I'm like, I'm so glad I didn't, because two of the DLCs were just, like, construction packs.
Yeah.
No, I don't want a construction pack. That should come with a game. But anyway, I've said enough.
Yeah.
It's a DLC. It took 2 hours, and I've almost spoken longer than the DLC took me to finish. You're going to talk to us a little bit about the Black Panther soundtrack.
Well, not the soundtrack. This is the album Music From and Inspired By the Movie of Black Panther. This is the one that Kendrick Lamar came in and produced and basically DJ'd, effectively, putting up a playlist of some of the most famous and some of the best current rap on the scene. And it's fine. I've said before that rap is not what I traditionally go for. I need to pay a lot of attention. I really need to focus on it to fully appreciate it and understand it. And there's nothing wrong with any of the music on this album. It's good rap. It's just kind of, all right, don't really get... This is a cheap cash-in on Black Panther that they really didn't need, considering the buzz around this movie. It reminds me of the times in Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man where there was music from and inspired by it, and there was just fucking tons of Nickelback and Paramore and fucking Evanescence and all that shit, just because they were the hot names around at that time. And it's like, if you listen really closely, you, oh, that's the song on the radio, just tiny little bit under in the scene where...
If you actually stayed around to the end of a credit, yeah, that song played after the main closing song.
Yeah, it's that sort of thing. It's like, okay, fine.
I've only seen this done successfully once, and that was...
The Crow?
No, well, no, but that kind of really seemed in sync with it. That was... actually seemed in sync with
There was a lot of music from The Crow in that one.
But not exactly. Yeah, but it didn't feel like it was just cashy and stuff that you didn't actually notice in the film.
Yeah.
There was a... when Blair Witch came out, obviously they had no money for a soundtrack.
Yeah.
There was a CD that came out called Josh's Blair Witch Mix.
Yeah.
You can't get anymore. I had it and I lost it. It was fucking incredible.
Yeah.
It had a real... But that was supposed to be a mixtape that one of the people who disappeared in the movie had made.
Yeah, it was in keeping with the marketing.
With the marketing, and it really worked. But other than that, you're right. Music from and inspired by is kind of a cheap cash-in.
Yeah. I mean, the one that actually did it best for me was... there was... when Tron Legacy came out, obviously Daft Punk did the music for that, and it was quite different to their traditional kind of Daft Punk sound. It was much more traditional orchestra, but it was still good. It was... possibly the best part of that movie. But then about 6 months later, they did basically a re-edit of the whole album, and they got guests in to put their own spin on some of the music from it. And it was fucking cool. It was way better than the actual soundtrack because it had the character of all these different artists with these tracks that you recognized if you were a fan of the music from it, and it's like, this is fucking cool. This is proper dance, trance music that just is, it's got identity. It is truly inspired by the Tron movie, which is cool. And so often it's not. It's just, all right, well, that's popular. Yeah, Kendrick Lamar, you can come in. You're big. You've made one of the songs or a couple of the songs, I think maybe, for the movie itself. Let's tie you in. Let's get some other bits that come in. It's like, all right. Maybe I really need to focus and listen to what's happening in each song, and there's more of a tie-in to the movie. Or maybe when I see the movie, I'll suddenly go, oh, I get it now. I understand why they chose all those songs. But without the movie as a reference, it's just a good rap mixtape.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, not at all.
Just don't expect if there's a couple of songs. I mean, these days, I wonder what the market for something like that is.
Yeah.
With Spotify, but back in the day... like, I think the Godzilla soundtrack, going back to 98. Yeah. That was actually a really good CD, a terrible film. Had some good, like, Silverchair, The Foo Fighters, Green Day, Jamiroquai, Puff Daddy, of course, had that song, the Led Zeppelin cover.
Come With Me.
The Warflowers covering David Bowie. There's some really good music on it.
Those sorts of albums were what got me to know so many other bands, because I would buy these albums because I love the movie. And it's just like, all right, I didn't know that there you could buy the actual composed music for the films. And I now generally prefer that. But this was kind of like, oh, this is really cool. I've got all these different bands. It's awesome.
And some of them are actually in the film.
Yeah.
A little bit.
You just get like 30% of them or 40% in the movie. And then the rest are, well, I didn't hear that anywhere in there. But
Sony already had a contract with Sony or something.
Yeah.
Sony wanted
it's
to put
fine. You know, whatever. They're pushing that to get into a few more CD players and stuff.
But back in those days, if you wanted to hear Come With Me and all that, it was actually a pretty good place to get it all, because if you liked all that sort of music on there, which I did, that was where you got it.
But
like
now
you guys got,
you just put in,
you can make that playlist on Spotify yourself.
Yeah, and then everyone can fucking listen to it as well.
Or Apple Music or whatever it is you choose to use.
It's there for everyone. So
I wonder why you would go out and buy that when you could buy a subscription.
It's just shameless marketing for no reason, because the Kendrick Lamar association with Black Panther has been so publicized since it first appeared, and the trailers for Black Panther have got apparently it's quite a popular rap song over the top of it. I don't really know it from any others, but it's sort of like, okay, fine, yep, I get that. What else? Why are you doing that? why this? It doesn't make any sense. You've people who are already into rap music and into superheroes, they're already going to be invested anyway.
Mm.
So they're already going to be in that ecosystem of music. So it's kind of, all right, well, and the thing is, most of it, even I've heard, and I'm like, I don't follow music.
So. I guess the thing is that, like, back in the day, again, even if that was the case, like, even if you'd heard all the songs or you had them, this was in one place.
Yeah.
So you put the CD in your car and you could take all your favourite songs in the CD on the one CD.
Yeah.
That was a buying impulse in of itself. Like, yeah, I know. I think I've got most of these on a few other sort of records, but these are all in the one CD.
Yeah.
Convenience. And this is going back to just before burning discs was even really a big deal.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you having it all in one place was what made the purchase worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I just, like, I don't understand what the audience is. If you want to, there's nothing particularly being made just for this. It's the stuff you can get everywhere else.
Yeah. If this was all kind of original music that the first time people were listening to it was in Black Panther. Sure. If this was kind of riffs on sort of like old school rap, sort of like modernizing it and kind of reintroducing it to the world, sure.
Or if you go like something like Spawn or Judgment Night, which was at the time sort of metal punk grunge bands with electronic techno artists. So
yeah.
I think Filter and Helmet. Or Pearl Jam and Cypress Hill.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. And that's kind of crossover. That was the only place you could ever hear that.
Yeah.
It's because it was made specifically for that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it doesn't sound like there's anything like that, though.
No, it's not. It's just good rap on a good compilation album. Aside from the Kendrick Lamar connection, it doesn't seem to have anything to Black Panther. So people who are saying, oh, the Black Panther soundtrack is really good, they're like, no, the compilation album inspired by Black Panther is really good. Wait for the actual soundtrack to come out, which apparently, according to reviews, is also very good. And it's a bit more actually kind of identifiable compared to a lot of the superhero stuff, which is very, very generic.
I imagine it'll have a very African tone.
Yeah, I mean, it's the best recent Marvel soundtrack, in my opinion, is Doctor Strange, because it's got the harpsichord playing throughout it, and it's different. It's a little bit weird. It fits with Doctor Strange, whereas anything from Ant-Man or any of the other ones, you kind of, I'm not sure which superhero movie this is for.
We should do that. We should have, like, you know, have a blind tasting challenge.
A blind track challenge.
Which Marvel film is from? That's it. We're doing that.
Okay, we'll do that.
No, maybe we could make that for the the Patreon subscribers, maybe.
Or, well, we'll start it off on Patreon and we'll release it elsewhere.
There you go. So that's a challenge.
Blind music challenge. For Marvel movies. Okay, cool.
So maybe there would be a lot of them by now.
Yeah, there will be, by the end of the year, there'll be 90. No, by the end of the year, there'll be 20. Fucking hell. And going back to what we were talking about last week, it is a week and a half between the release of Avengers 3 and Deadpool 2. A week and a half.
It's going to be a showdown.
That's going to be right in the mud. Last but not least, just a quick note for everyone that our next show, episode 16, will be a spoiler cast for Black Panther. So Trav and I will both have seen it by the time we're recording, and it'll be all about Black Panther. So if you've got any questions, comments, concerns, hit us up at facebook.com/group/FryBrainProductions. You can go to @ArmchairFlops on Twitter. We have our own Twitter now. I actually finally got around to that. Or our personal ones, @EvilTrav, @TheFriedBrain. So, hit us up and we'll try and keep an eye out for certain things if you tell us to keep an eye out. Any last thoughts, Trav?
My last thoughts? I'm just going to say it again. I think I might have been wrong about Black Panther. It's not looking good for my prediction.
Yeah, mine neither. I am kind of putting an addendum on all of my predictions for 2018. Reverse them all.
Yes. And I'm going to stick by my computer game films are going to go well.
Well,
Maybe Tomb Raider VC. Maybe it'll be this one.
Tomb Raider, maybe. Obviously, we've got the Mario animated movie that's in discussions, but...
Animated movies don't count.
Shigeru Miyamoto recently came out and said, well, if the script comes back and we don't like it, we're not going to do it. Because movies get talked about in Hollywood and never appear for all sorts of reasons and all the time. So we're going to do that just in case. Mm. So even then, still not sure.
My predictions are going in the memory hole.
On that note, ladies and gentlemen, thank you and good night.
Good night.